We'll start at the beginning. Tell us when you were born, where you were born, what kind of community it was, and a little bit about your parents.
Debbie, do you want to say the date?
Oh, thank you. This is April 1st, 2024, not April Fool's Day, because this is going to be a real recounting. We're on Zoom. This is Debbie Goldman, who's doing the interviewing of Gladys Finnegan, spelled Finnigan, correct?
Yes.
And Hannah Goldman is doing our sound recording, and Jeff Reckenbach is in Cleveland or somewhere thereabouts as he's driving a car while we're doing this interview. Okay, now we'll go back to the question. Tell
Okay.
us where you were born,
Good
when.
morning. Good morning. I was born in the same town that I live in now, which is Cortland Manor, New York, in 1962. I was the last of five children. My parents, Joseph and Gladys, were my father was involved in real estate sales and insurance sales. He owned his own business, which ended up closing, and then he went to work for New York Telephone Company in the real estate division. My mom worked in retail. She was a stay-at-home mom early in my life. And then when I was probably school age, 8 or 9, she did go to work in retail and continued to do that. And they both retired and then went back to work. They worked into their 80s. My mom in the library, and my father went back to real estate and selling real estate condominiums. So they were very active and independent. And my father passed away when he was 88, and my mom at the age of 90. They both lived independently and a good, long, healthy life. I moved out of Cortland Manor temporarily, but I came back. I live in the town with my husband. I have two children, ages 26 and 28. And I retired from CWA, and I've been enjoying retirement since December 31st of 2022.
Lovely. And you were blessed to have your parents with you for all that time. Let's just do a little bit more about your childhood. Cortland Manor is at New York, and tell me about the community of Cortland Manor.
Cortland Manor is in Westchester County, New York, which is about 50 miles north of New York City, of Manhattan, about 35 miles north of the Bronx. It's a town. I don't know how many people are in the town. It's fairly large.
A working class town, middle class town.
It's a middle class town. A lot of blue collar workers, some middle management. There's no, it's not it's not a high CEO sort of town. It's definitely a working class town.
And your background, you come from Irish background, Catholic?
It's mixed. Yes, I was raised Catholic. I'm mostly Irish. I do have other parts of German and English. Mostly Irish, though, which was what everybody seemed to be most proud of.
And when you think back to your youth, what kinds of values did you learn as a child that you think reflected in the kind of work you did for the union?
Hard work, and one of my mother's favorite words was stick-to-itiveness. So if you started something, you finished it. You didn't quit. You didn't give up. You just stayed with it until you figured it out. If you didn't know how to do it, you just stayed with it until you figured it out. And you just don't give up.
And did you, what high school did you go to?
I went to Walter Pannis High School.
Is that a public or? private school.
It's a public school. It was in the Lakeland School District. There were two high schools that serviced our community. One middle school, and then we broke off into two different high schools.
And did you go to college after you
No.
graduated?
No.
You went.
I took some college classes, but just local at the community college, and decided that I just wanted to work. I got a job at the phone company when I was 19 years old.
So tell us about that. Your father worked for New York Tel, so I'm guessing that he helped you get the job.
No, you had to see, well, he probably got me the test. He told me how to go through the testing process. So my father worked for the phone company, and my brother worked for the phone company. And my father's best friend actually worked for the phone company also, and that's how my father got in. So I had heard that I wanted to be a field technician. I wanted to climb telephone poles, and they were just starting to hire women into those roles then. There were not that many. It was mostly male dominated. So I applied to work for the phone company, probably when I was 18, for those field tech positions, and I wasn't getting called. And then my sister, one of my sisters, got hired as a telephone operator. And I still didn't get called. And then another sister got hired as a clerk, and I was still waiting, even though I had applied first. So I wasn't quite sure why that was. And I contacted the employment office, and they told me the reason that I wasn't getting called was that they just weren't hiring field techs at the time. But if I wanted to work as an operator, I could start right away. So I said, okay, I'll take the job as an operator, figuring I'll just get my foot in the door that way. So that's what I did. I became a telephone operator in July of 1981, in Briarcliff Manor, New York. And it was kind of my first real full-time job, if you will, with, a 40-hour, 37-hour work week and benefits. It was exciting. Wasn't the job that I wanted, though.
And you never had the opportunity to test to be a technician?
Well, things kind of changed, and I didn't really want to do that anymore because I got involved with the union. So, and also at the time, it was easier to get hired off the street as a field tech than it was to get promoted into those fields. Once you got an entry-level job as an operator or a clerk, it was kind of difficult to get an upgrade to those jobs. That's one thing.
Interesting.
We changed we th there were some barriers that were in place with the transfer system that gave an extra benefit to people who worked in these technical jobs, so that they got the job ahead of everybody else. There were steps that they had to follow to fill a vacancy, and some of it was geographical, that they would look in certain areas first. But then, if you had certain job experience, you got an added benefit. So even if they had less seniority, if you were in a repair center, for example, answering phone calls, you would get an adder, and you would get the job before an operator or a clerk. So it was a little, I felt it was a little discriminatory the way that they did it at the time. But we were able to change that later on in bargaining for other workers.
It's interesting because you were hired in 81. The EEO consent decree had expired. And so New York Tel was not under any kind of obligation to hire more women into technician positions. So that's interesting, your story. I don't think we've interviewed anyone who was an operator in the early 80s. So I'm going to ask you a few questions. Tell us about your work. Was this, had they yet brought in the TPS, which I forget what it stands for, but those TPS systems?
It was TSPS.
Thank you.
And I forget what it stands for also, but it was just TSPS was just the type of equipment that it was. We were really toll operators, and there were two types of operators. One was toll, and the other one was directory assistance. So I started as the toll operator. I never worked in the directory assistance portion, which is information. The toll operators handled long distance calls, collect calls. If you had trouble getting through to a number, we would help you dial the number. Overseas calls, person to person, credit card billing, all sorts of billing, any call that had needed assistance with billing. Pay phones, we c collected the coins on pay phones. It was shift work, meaning that the workers came in basically every 15 minutes. They'd start a new shift. So if the shift started at 7, if your office opened at 7, so a couple of people would start at 7, a few more at 7:15, 7:30, 7:45, 8 o'clock, and that went on all day long. People coming and going. And you got different shifts every day of the week. It was a five, you worked 5 days a week, any given 5 days, so Sunday through Saturday. Some offices were open 24 hours. My office was not open 24 hours, so thankfully I didn't have to work overnights. We also had what they called split shifts. So you would split shift meant you would come in the morning, work, for example, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., and then you'd leave, and you'd have to come back at 5 o'clock and work until 8, or come back at 6 and work till 9, finish up your shift. That was very disruptive. Some people like those shifts, but if you can imagine, you're working 12 hours really over the course of the day, having to commute twice to your workplace and home twice. And getting paid for 7.5. So, wasn't like you really could do much else with your life.
I've been told that some people who had young children or elementary school age children liked it because they could come home, be with the kids, and then go
That's
back to
true.
work.
That's true. There were some people who liked it. But and those people who liked it were able to get that shift all the time. If that was your first choice, you could have it. But it was there were far and few between people who actually liked it.
How many people were in your office at any one time during the day?
Probably 60.
And did most people live in the area?
Within, I'd say we all lived within 20 miles of the office.
And of the 60 who worked there, how many were men?
Probably 7 or 8.
Oh, there were that many.
Yeah, young.
Okay.
Young people, like my age.
Then.
Yeah. Then 19, 20.
So you actually interacted with customers. It wasn't just about pushing buttons.
Oh no, it's right. There, I spoke to several hundred customers a day, and there was a lot of pressure to handle calls quickly. You've probably heard of the term AWT, that stood for average work time, and that was a measurement that they used to measure your job performance, how fast you could handle calls. And most calls I think they wanted us to handle calls on an average of 30 seconds a call, 30 seconds a call probably. So that was in and out. And once one call dropped off, the other one was right there behind it. You didn't control the call. You didn't push the button to say, I'm ready to talk now. They just popped in.
And were you monitored? Right.
Yes.
And in what ways?
Well, they would actually have a position which looked exactly like our position, which was we had a very it was a very large console that we sat at, two people side by side, at identical consoles. And the managers had a monitoring station that they would plug into. It was the same identical station that we had, and they could see every button that we pushed. They could hear the customer, they could hear us, and they would monitor us and listen
How
to us.
could they see the buttons? I'm trying to picture that 40 years ago.
So if you push a button, it would light up on their console. Whatever button you pushed would light up.
So you would get evaluated both on the way you talk, on a range of items. What were some of the items that you'd get?
Well, they had set phrases that you had to use in order to talk politely. They didn't want you just to speak the way you would normally speak at home. You had to use their phrases. You had to, if there was any pauses, you after a certain amount of time, you had to say, "I'm sorry for the delay. One moment, please. I'll be right with you." This is so long ago, Debbie.
Well, it's very interesting because I think that a lot of people have the picture of the old days of the operators at the long cord boards and with the plugs going in and out. And as I understand it, in the period when you started, that was no longer the way that the technology worked, or and that operators, as you said, were sitting at consoles.
Yeah.
And I think it was one of the first places that the digital switching came in, and you were working on electronic equipment, and it changed the work.
Probably correct, yes. So you were tied to this equipment, but with a headset. We used to plug in on the left-hand side, and you would have to exit. You had to get in your chair a certain way. Enter from the left, exit from the right, because when you were going on a break, someone would come in next to you to relieve you. They would put their plug in. There were two plugs side by side. They would plug in, and you couldn't pull your plug out until they plugged in, because they would take over to relieve you, and you. They'd come in from the left, you exit from the right.
If
So,
you had to go to the bathroom, at a time when it wasn't your break time, what did you do?
kind of humiliating that you had to let them know that you needed to use the bathroom, or you needed a what they called an incidental break. If you took too many of those, that was a problem. They would call you out on that. On the top of your console was like a flat shelf. Some offices had red cups, like a solo cup that you would have to put up on your desk to let them know that you needed a break. While other places had these little cards that were marked. They had different cards for different things. One was if you were at the end of your shift and going home. Another one was if you were taking a scheduled break. And then there was one marked incidental. That was for bathroom, or if you needed to leave for a personal reason. And sometimes, you'd have to wait until they relieved you. Back when I first started, they would often leave you waiting there for 15, 20 minutes before they would come and tell you it was okay to use the bathroom. Which is.
I'm not going to comment on the pun that you used about you'd have to wait till they relieved you.
Right. Well, we were able we started changing that over time.
I'm going to want to hear about that.
Yeah. And it was remarkable to me. One thing that really bothered me when we started working, they would post a schedule. I told you we started every 15 minutes. So you had to note your schedule for the week, write it down in a calendar. They would give you a little slip of paper. And they didn't call your shifts or your tours of work shifts or tours. They called them tricks. And we were all mostly women, and they would refer to the tours that we worked as tricks. And the operators were all okay with it. It bothered me. I think it was even in our contract that we would be assigned tricks.
So tell me what you liked about that job and what you didn't like.
I liked the people that worked in the office. There was a wide range of workers in terms of age. I liked the senior workforce. They were funny and engaging, and the young folks were fun to hang out with too. I met a lot of nice people. The work was boring, but sometimes funny also. I mean, we had a lot of different types of customers and characters that would repeaters that would call back all the time. Sometimes you just talk to lonely people too. They were just lonely and would call up just to have somebody on the other end of a phone, older people. So there were a lot of fun stories that came out of operator services. They had the office atmosphere was it was caring. They had office parties. Some of the best office parties that I've ever been to came out of operator services. Everybody cooked and brought food in and took care of each other in that way. So the people aspect is what I like most.
And what didn't you like?
I didn't like the way that they managed it. I didn't like it was a little bit of a demeaning, the whole calling it tricks. They just didn't treat you very well. Making you wait to go to the bathroom, things like that just didn't sit right with me.
Would you call it paternalistic?
I guess that would be a word to describe it. But
I'm
the managers were women, but they were not always nice. There were some nice ones, but there were some mean ones. They were vicious.
There were a lot of rules, right?
A lot of rules.
Did you have to wear a skirt?
No.
Oh, you could wear pants.
Yes.
Okay. So I think we've had a lot about what it was like to work as a toll operator and also about the, I don't know, the relationships within the office. You, at that point, let's get to the union story, which was a very interesting story. At that point, you were represented by the TTU, is that correct? Telephone Traffic Union, which was affiliated with TIU, which I don't know what that is.
You know what? I was trying to recall exactly what that stood for myself, and I couldn't. I think it's Telephone International Union. So, yes, I was TTU, and when I first got hired, I signed a union card, and I don't remember having much interaction with anything union after that until we went on strike in 1983, and my office was set back from the road a bit. We were not part of a garage. We didn't share workspaces with other departments. It was just operators. So we walked around on a picket line. We were assigned to picket duty, and a couple hours, not even a full shift. We probably a couple hours a week, 10 or 20 hours a week. So that was my first involvement with the union. I didn't know what the issues were. I don't remember anybody from the union coming around and talking to us before the contract. And I don't remember going to any union meetings. I don't know if they had any. I can't say that they didn't. If they did, I didn't attend them. No, I was
And was the strike, TTU represented at that point all the downstate operators for New Yorktel? Who did they represent?
So the TIU had
Okay.
different affiliates in it. The Telephone Traffic Union, there were two telephone traffic unions. One was downstate New York, that was my local. And then there was upstate New York, which ended up joining CWA also as Local 1112. They also had the two commercial units. I think they were CUTW. And they ended up as Local 1105, and the upstate commercial union went with IBEW and their Local 2213. And then there were the two accounting units, one from downstate and one from upstate. So we were all part of TIU. And then
And that's who was on strike, all of those units
Yeah,
in 83.
and CWA was on strike at the same time. Our contracts all expired on the same t at the same time. So they didn't, I don't think they bargained regionally together, but we always heard that our union rode on the coattails of CWA. So whatever CWA got, we would pretty much get in terms of money benefits. The local agreements, we bargained on our own.
So it's a pretty big story, the organizing that went on of the operators joining CWA. So tell that story.
Okay, so the TIU was looking to merge with AFSCME at the time.
Why AFSCME?
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I could guess. They probably had some sort of arrangement for transfer of leadership, but that's just a guess. So the workers didn't really like that idea. And CWA started, they started a task force of organizers, which I joined. My brother was a steward with Local 1101 and Local 1101 in the Bronx. I went to a meeting in at their office with Joe McAleer and a bunch of other union folks from CWA about organizing. And there was a few operators from different locations, probably 8 or 10 of us all together that kind of started going to these CWA meetings. And CWA started organizing from the ground up, started putting together a campaign so that we could tell our union that we wanted to join CWA instead of AFSCME. So once that started, IBEW started doing the same thing. And there was a big fight between all of the unions, I guess, because the Nationals, TIU, still wanted AFSCME. Ended up putting that to a vote, which failed in all of the units, the AFSCME affiliation merger. And then all of the units individually voted independently at different times whether they wanted to join CWA or IBEW. Our ballots had a choice between the two unions. And 5 out of the 6 went with CWA. And that's what our unit did.
And
So,
that was in 1983,
1985.
1985. Was it fun to be organizing?
It was fun. It was a little scary, but I didn't have anything to lose. I think I was still living at home with my parents, so it wasn't like I was going to lose my house or my apartment if I lost my job. But the union wasn't fond of what we were doing initially.
Which union?
Our union, Telephone Traffic Union,
Oh.
once they heard that there were these mobilizers or organizers internally, they tried to stop us. I had taken a leave of absence to go work for CWA to go around to all the different offices. And my union, the telephone traffic union, got that blocked. They had me pulled back to work. So I couldn't take the leave of absence. But we had a lot of offices in just my local alone. We had over 60 workplaces
Oh my goodness.
in downstate New York. And downstate New York covered Westchester South. So we had all of New York City and Long Island and Westchester.
So you traveled around. Oh, well, you weren't allowed to go off the job. So how did you did it when you weren't working for the New York Tel?
I did it when I wasn't working for New York Tel. I did it at night, days off. And they also had, have you ever heard the term AE? In operator services, you could buy time back from the company. And this was a weird thing too. You had a job so that you could work, and then you'd beg for time off without pay. Which we all did. You could sign up at the beginning of the day or at the beginning of the week and ask for time off without pay. And if they didn't need people on any given day, you could get time off. And that was, anywhere from 15 minutes up to the full shift. You could take back and get time off.
It
Some
was
people,
called AE.
yeah, absence excused. Yeah.
So you would do that, you're
I would
saying.
sign up for as much of that as I could get and then go to work for CWA. Yeah.
So why did you want CWA? And what did you tell other workers why they should vote CWA?
Well, after being on strike, and my brother was a CWA member, was a CWA chief steward in 1101. So he was fairly involved. I saw their unity. I saw how they talked to people. I saw a presence in their union that I wasn't seeing in my own. I felt more power in CWA, or it looked like they had more power than we had in telephone traffic union. And I wanted a more of a voice for the workers in our department.
Now, 1101 represented mostly male techs. How did they understand the workplace of the operators, which was so different?
Well, I don't know that they understood the actual work. I don't know how to answer that. I mean,
Okay.
they understood that we needed to make improvements, that we needed more of a voice, and we needed better representation. We had so many shared, my workplace wasn't shared with other people, but I mentioned we had over 60 workplaces. A lot of them were in central offices where all different types of phone workers worked. So you would, when you worked in one of those offices, you saw how other people were treated at work compared to how you were treated at work as an operator. The reps were kind of in the same boat. Anybody in a call center, had stricter rules than people on the outside.
And the operator is even stricter than the service reps at that period.
Probably.
Was it also the case that many operators had other family members like you who were in 1101?
Well, so interestingly, one of the other people that I, the person, one person that I met who was very important in my life, as part of the organizing into CWA, was a clerk who worked in Manhattan, and I had never met her before. That was miles away. I wasn't a New York City girl at the time. was Joyce Petrella. And Joyce was in our local, and she was doing the grassroots organizing too. So I met her at some CWA meetings, and we became friends, lifelong friends. And Joyce was dating Chris Shelton at the time. And Chris was the chief steward in Local 1101. That's when I met Chris. Dennis Traynor was the chief steward in 1101. I met him there also. Lifelong friends were made right from the beginning there. She didn't have family, but she knew Chris. So I don't know if that's how she got in or if they met at work, but as far as the other operators that I worked with, I don't know if they had family members who were in the union. Who were in CWA. I don't remember that being the case.
So you all, when you voted CWA, and who was the district vice president then?
Morty Barr.
What was his role in this organizing?
Well, I mean, he was the vice president, so he wasn't, on the day to day. But it's kind of funny. I was, gosh, they started organizing probably in 83. It was a long campaign, and we voted in 85. But I was very young. I wanted to be a leader in the union. I wanted to run for office, so I did run for shop steward in my work group and was elected as such. But I wanted to run for business agent. They called it something different at the time, but I wanted to run for business agent in our new CWA local. And we had it all lined up, who was going to run for what position. And then things kind of got changed around a little bit because somebody from the Telephone Traffic Union came out and said they would support CWA. So now we had to include that person. So everybody kind of got pushed down. And that meant I was getting pushed out of what I wanted to run for. So I didn't think it was fair the way that it was handled. And I can't believe, looking back, I can't believe that I even did this, but I must have called Morty at some point. And I wasn't even in CWA at the time. I was, just some kid, and told him that I didn't feel I was being treated right, and he invited me to come and meet with him. And I went down to Pine Street. I was so nervous, and met with him and talked it out. And things didn't really end up changing from the decisions that had been made, but I was really impressed that he took the time out of his schedule to meet with me, and that stuck with me. That's how CWA worked.
That was quite a story. You want to say anything more about what you thought of Morty?
I loved Morty. He was just so genuine. He really took the time to make sure that people understood why we were doing things the way we were doing them. And if you didn't understand, he took the time personally to make sure that you did, in my opinion. And that just from that point on, he came to bargaining in 1994. He came to bargaining after having discussions with the company about this telecommunications technical associate deal that he worked out, where people could go to school on company paid time to get a degree in telecommunications, and that really helped us resolve a surplus issue. And I just thought he was brilliant.
That was, as I recall, the creating a new top craft title. And this was during the digital transition, right? So it was also for the company, they were getting people who were trained. to work on new technology, the digital technology. Is that correct?
It is correct, but it wasn't. I don't know if it was Morty's idea or whose idea it was, but we were in bargaining when I first heard about that. But we were facing layoffs. 16, I think 16,800 is the number that sticks in my mind as we went into bargaining, and the company had announced that they intended to lay off or reorganize that many jobs out of our bargaining unit. And we probably had about 60,000, so it was a good percentage of our workforce that they were looking to get rid of. And by people who were signing up for this, going to school one day a week, I mean that's 20% job security just in those jobs alone. So it was kind of genius.
We'll get back to 94 or whichever year it was, 94, 95, bargaining, 92. Let's jump back. So now you're in CWA and you're in 1101. Do you have your own seat on the executive board? How do they incorporate?
Okay, so I think I'm confused you a little bit, maybe. We did not join into lo Local 1101. Local 1101 and many other locals worked on the organizing the operators and working on organizing the reps into CWA, but we came in as our own locals. We came in as affiliates, and when we joined in 1985, we became Local 1110. We were our own local with a full executive board and our own autonomy. And we had an affiliation agreement where dues were a staggered increase up and when we until we reached full dues. I think there was a 3-year period where they increased a little bit each year. And we had some guaranteed. We had a position on the regional bargaining committee with New York Telephone. We also had AT&T workers, so we were on that bargaining as well.
Oh, you had AT&T operators?
Yeah.
Okay. And
And clerk.
if you remember back, how many members did you have when you
We had
became?
about 6,500.
And I am guessing that the entire time that you were in the leadership of that local, you saw the numbers going down, 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 down.
Yes, technological changes had a devastating effect on the number of members that we had. Yes.
And talk a little bit about the demographics of that 6,500. White, black, what percent?
I couldn't give you mostly female. Geographically, it depends. In New York City, it was mostly black women. When you got to the suburbs, Long Island and Westchester, it was probably a lower, lower percentage, probably 70, 30, maybe.
And in your leadership of the union, were black women in the leadership?
Yes. Yes. I don't I'm trying to recall back when I first started. We probably had about half and half. And we had male representatives also on the e-board. Not too many though.
So you were elected a business agent, and you say after restructuring, I also represented Manhattan and then was elected president of my local in 1993, remained in that position till we merged with Local 1108 in 2004. So that's a long period. What were some of the major issues that you were dealing with and some of the progress that you were making in terms of bargaining. You said that you made a lot of changes to some of the rules and oversight.
So the first bargaining that I really took part in was in 1986. I was involved in the strikes, but as far as being at a bargaining table, 1986 was my first experience with bargaining.
And you were on the quote local table because by that point, you also had 9X as a, I guess, regional bargaining.
No, in that year, I was with the AT&T table under Jim Irvine.
That's interesting.
So, and that was a that I with no experience, that was probably the worst bargaining to start on because it was 1986. It was the first bargaining after the breakup of the Bell system, and we had all the regional Bell operating contracts that had to be merged into one agreement. I think there were 27 agreements that had to be merged into one. And coming from New York, we had some pretty good contracts, even though we were part of the telephone traffic union, because we had bargained closely, I guess, through the years with CWA, we had some pretty good contracts. And we were at the top of those 27, in my opinion, as far as working conditions. And what was expected of us was to come up with one agreement. And unfortunately, the people at the top stood to lose the most. And the people at the bottom of contracts, they stood to gain because they were going to land somewhere in the middle. That was very tough. It was tough to accept and tough to we did as much as we could to protect everything that we had with little breakouts and such, but it was a different looking contract than the one we went in with. It was tough.
This was the AT&T communications contract.
Yes.
And your role there was to merge the contractual agreements for the various AT&T
Right, from all,
operators.
it wasn't just operators, it was everybody, all of the units, technical, commercial, all of the units that had that were represented by the by AT&T. I think there were 27.
Jeff, maybe you can help me understand. There was a long lines contract before this, but that was not a.
Yeah, so after post divestiture, AT&T retained the long distance business, so that would have been all the toll operators, in addition to the long lines, in addition to the labs, some of the different and sundry units that retained with AT&T, and it was trying to take those 27 contracts then and come out of there with one common contract, I guess. I mean, I wasn't in on those negotiations, but that was the Irvine office, him and Ron Allen and that crowd that were responsible for trying to bring all that together. And you could imagine, you have 27 contracts. You've got the employer trying to grab the worst of those 27 contracts, and us trying to grab the best of those, which likely would have been, a contract out of New York State, where you had the best union density. I can imagine that had to be brutal going through that process. We did a semi process of that in the Midwest, but only five contracts.
Well, we've talked about this before in some of the interviews, and the way I'm understanding it is that some kinds of work that had been done by the local Bell companies, such as installation of equipment, were now moved into the new AT&T long distance company. So those people had been under local Bell contracts and now were
That's right.
moved. So I understand that. In terms of operator services for AT&T, I would have thought that they were under the long lines contract, not under local Bell, but
No,
I guess I'm wrong.
they would have under local Bell contracts at that point. So it would have been a 9X or a New
New
York
York.
telephone contract
Right.
at the
Right.
time.
And in fact, as I understand it, this is before this contract even is when AT&T came to CWA and said, we have to create a whole new, well, now I'm talking about service reps, not about operators. So I'm off.
So the directory
Okay.
assist the directory assistance operators stayed bargaining with New
Right.
Yorktel or 9X. The toll operators became AT&T.
But they had been, I see. So all of those different contracts for the operators. Okay, so you were saying it was a really very challenging bargaining.
Well, particularly because I had never bargained before. So it was a challenging bargaining for an experienced bargainer. It was very challenging for a brand. It was very tough.
And you had run for and got elected to this bargaining committee, correct?
No, I didn't have
Oh.
to run for it. We had, because we affiliated, we were guaranteed a position on bargaining tables. And I think because they wanted a representative from each contract. I think they wanted one from each contract. But I ended up there somehow. I don't know how. My president told me to go and I went.
Who was your president?
Paula Buckley.
It must have been a huge bargaining committee.
It was very large, and they broke out into groups. We bargained in Somerset, New Jersey, I believe.
And as I recall, you went on strike in 86, correct?
Yeah, a brief strike, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks maybe.
Do you want to say anything about the strike?
Well, I was actually at the bargaining table, so I didn't have too much picket line experience, or discussions with the members at that point. We were kind of locked up in Somerset, New Jersey, but I just remember it. Well, it wasn't that long. It was not a particularly bitter strike. My unit, the operators, the strike that we had. I just want to go back to the strike of '83 when we were Telephone Traffic Union. I didn't know this at the time, but out of those 6,500 workers, there were a lot of people who crossed the picket line. Not in my workplace, but in New York City and other places. And after the strikes ended, really not much changed. People weren't treated any differently. It was almost like they turned their head to the union didn't do anything to them. Nobody brought up any charges against them. And when we joined CWA, we took a strong stance on that. That people shouldn't scab, and we educated folks on it. And our first strike in 1980, I forget which strike it was. It was before the 89 strike, maybe the 86, or must have been 86. We had about 500 scabs in our local, and we had to file charges under the Constitution and go through that process of bringing them up on charges for 500 cases. And we did that for every single one, and fined everybody who crossed the picket line a day's pay for every day that they crossed. And of course they didn't want to pay it and didn't pay it. And in a lot of those cases, we ended up having to bring people to court to collect the money and set up payment schedules with folks. And we did that. And the next strike was 1989. After that was 1989, and the number of people who crossed the picket line was greatly reduced. So I was so happy that we took that stance, because it really helped us have stronger picket lines and stronger strikes in the future.
What a story. It didn't lead to resentment against the union.
No. The whole culture of like not, you know, a scab is a scab and you treat somebody like a scab, you know, I basically put somebody, you're not in my life anymore. If you cross a picket line, we started, that was hard for people to do because it was the office environment, they were friends and people didn't want to stop talking to their friends. But there was a lot of pressure put on people, but also support. For people who legitimately, you know, I have to work, I have children, I'm a single mom, I need money. There was a lot of support, and CWA's Defense Fund and Members Relief Fund was a lifesaver for folks. You know, it really helped people stick with the union, and do the right thing.
Talk about some of the bargaining you did that gave protections to the operators around working conditions.
So I my first year at the regional bargaining table was in 1994. That was the first bargaining after I became president.
This is New York Tel now, or 9X now, right?
I think that was still 9X. Yeah. When did we become Bell Atlantic? 98?
Yeah. Or 96, 97, 98. Yeah, 98.
So, I mean, we had made a lot of improvements prior to that in terms of working conditions. We changed those. You know, we got extra pay for holidays, got triple pay on some holidays, a lot of improvements in that, in pay treatment, language in the contracts as well. Benefits, we were able to hold on to benefits. 1989, was a huge fight over benefits, and after a 17-week strike, we were victorious in keeping our no premiums for health care. In 1994, the bargaining committee that I served on, we were facing restructuring, re-engineering, where the company wanted to eliminate 16,000 jobs across all bargaining units. Huge job security issues were at stake. So that's the year that we gained job security in the contract.
What does that mean?
We got no layoff provisions for all employees, unless there was some sort of external event. The company couldn't lay people off. They had to, you know, they could reduce the payroll in different ways through voluntary retirement incentives. We improved the upgrade and transfer plan language to take away those barriers for the inside forces to get to the outside technical jobs, to get to the more technical jobs, which were higher paying jobs that our members really wanted to get into. We had seen the company start to close a lot of work locations. I mentioned we had over 60 work locations in my local. They were starting to close them down and consolidate work groups, which made it hard on workers because they had to commute further. And for people in the suburbs, if you had to commute into the city, that was an added expense, not only just added time, but added expense in terms of gas, tolls, trains, things like that. So we got this 35-mile language in our contract where the company couldn't transfer people more than an additional 35 miles from their to the add that to their existing commute. So it limited the amount of offices that they could close. It didn't stop them from closing, but it slowed them down a little bit. And it made it hard, it made it impossible for them to take a worker from Westchester and force transfer them to the East End of Long Island or to.
Gladys, these are huge achievements. How do, and you didn't did it without a strike. How do you get them?
Oh. We every bargaining that we went into in 1994, I think we went into early bargaining. an
You
early
must have, because the cycle would have been 95. The contracts were 92, 95, 98. Yeah. Anyway,
okay,
that
maybe.
doesn't sound right. Okay.
No,
Maybe
you're
not.
right. No, you're right. You're right. I didn't think about that, but yes. So we must have gone into early bargaining, but it seems like every time we went into early bargaining, expecting to get a contract in 3 months, we were still there for 10 or 12 months anyway.
And who was the vice president of District 1 at that point?
In 94, I think it was Larry Mancino.
Jeff is nodding his head yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so
I
back
know
to my question.
Larry was 98, but I wasn't sure about 94 if it was him or Jan Pierce.
We'll check.
What do you think,
At
Jan?
any rate, my question remains: huge achievements, a no layoff clause, no forced transfer past 35 miles. You talked about the positive of the new title and people were off work, but these are huge achievements. And somebody,
The
you know,
whole
we're
bargaining was focused around force adjustments of war. It was all about those jobs. And I think that's the year that we came up with the telecommunications technical associate also, that I mentioned that Morty came and talked to us about for the college degrees for the highest title. You know what I'm talking about, Debbie?
yeah, I'm still asking you to tell people in the future who will be like me in awe of what you achieved. When you think back to it, how did you have the power to win those things?
We had the power because the members were behind us. The members, ever since 1989, in 1989, I think that's when we started mobilizing. There was District 1 did a fantastic job of understanding what the workers did, each worker, each title did on a day-to-day basis. They understood the need for leverage and they knew how to get it. Other than strikes, we knew that strikes weren't the answer for a lot of what we needed to get. We needed to come up with other ways of putting pressure. So we used internal pressure with the members. It was, of course, political pressure that we had a great political program and Bob Master pulling all those strings. But really, the members understood every step of the way, what we were facing, whether it was healthcare cost shifting, re-engineering with job security, they understood the issues. And so I think having they drove everything, the members.
Did you do work to rule kinds of mobilization?
Yes.
Give
Yes.
some examples of what that meant.
So I mentioned before in 1989 really was my first experience with bar with mobilizing. Do you want to hear how that came about?
Yep.
So, Bob Master was the kind of the chairperson of some of the meetings that we had, and the District 1 put together a task force of people from the various bargaining units that came and met with Bob and some other folks from the national staff reps. And we just talked about the work that everybody did. They got a good understanding of all the different titles, what the shifts were, what those operations looked like, and got workers to talk about what could be done to impact the company without breaking the rules.
Is
So
this 1989 or a different year?
This is 19. This was 1989. It
Okay.
started around, it started early because of that cost shifting with that Verizon, not Verizon, 9X. We started to put in, our contract expired in May, in August rather. In May, they started to try to take money out of everybody's paychecks for healthcare cost shifting for premiums. And they wanted us to sign cards saying that we agreed to have this money taken out of our paychecks. And we had to mobilize around that and get people to not sign those cards because that wasn't something that the union had agreed to. There was a big dispute between CWA and the company about whether this had been agreed to in a previous contract. CWA said we didn't agree to it, and the company said we did. So we knew early on that there was a fight there. And that's when this whole, mobilization was a new word to us. We didn't know what that was. We just knew how to strike. So Bob met with us all. He put together the toolbox sort of ideas that we got from workers in the field on how we could impact the company. And there were things that seemed very small, but they built solidarity and they built strength among the members and unity. They, tapping pencils on your workstation when you're an operator doesn't seem like much, but if 60 people are tapping pencils at the same exact time for 5 minutes, it sends a message to the company that we were united. And so there were even, we'd start small and build our way up. By the end, or by the time we were ready to go on strike, we'd start doing practice picketing, lunchtime rallies, more of a, more, things that people had to come together for.
And you were doing those things during the bargaining of 94, 95.
Every bargaining after that one, yes.
And would you do education too with the members? And how did that work? Did you have manuals that you would go through or
We
told
had
people?
trainings in different years, the Stewards Army training. I think that came in 2006. We did trainings before that, just smaller groups. I forget what those trainings were called. But we did some trainings of stewards and activists in pretty much every round of bargaining. We did flyers. We would do phone trees. The starting the mobilization plan of 10 members for one mobilizer, getting the word out about certain things, and if there was going to be an activity. Sit and visit workplaces, go into the lounges, meet with people during their breaks or before their shift, after their shift. In operator services in the commercial world, it was a little tougher than the technicians. The technicians could have a garage meeting before everybody dispatched in the morning, and get the word out very quickly to their entire group all at once. It took us a little longer because of the nature of the job.
How
We
would you do it?
had to spend more time in the workplaces. Had to actually be there, from the first shift up until the early afternoon, and then maybe have somebody there at night that was spreading the word as well.
Oh, in the break room, you mean?
Yeah.
So you were elected local president in 1993, remained in that position till you merged with Local 1108. In 2004, talk about why you merged and the process.
So, one of the reasons why we merged was I was going to work for the National Union, and we were smaller in size. It was tough to financially, it was tough to keep a local going.
How many members approximately?
It's a total, I would be totally guessing. Probably 2,000 or less.
So you drop by two-thirds by that point.
Yeah. Maybe more. Maybe more. So it was tough to it was tough to keep a local going financially. We did have a space that we rented, which was expensive. We had salaries. Our geography was still pretty widespread, so you needed a lot of union reps that could go around to the various locations. It wasn't something you could do with just a couple of folks. So it just became hard to manage, and we thought it would make sense to merge when we were at a point where we still had money in the bank and still had income coming in and could have some leverage to negotiate a good merger agreement with a local where we would have a voice on their executive board, get a spot on the executive board, so that our concerns would be addressed.
And 1108 represented whom?
They were a plant local in Suffolk County, New York.
And why did you choose? Go on.
We had discussions with a couple of locals around that time. We had considered really three locals. I won't give you the numbers because it doesn't, I'd just rather not. But, one local said it didn't, it wasn't something that they wanted to do because the dues income really wasn't, we weren't a high paid craft. So the dues income was not what they were looking for in a merger. And then the other local that we considered didn't work out for one reason or another. I forget exactly why. And local 1108 was where we landed.
Who was the president then of that local?
George Welker.
What would you say to folks today who may be thinking about decline in their membership should they merge? What
Well,
did you learn from this? What advice would you give?
it was important to me, and I think I don't CWA doesn't always enforce constitutional requirements of locals, but I think that there's sometimes when locals get to a certain point where you can't really effectively represent your members, but you also can't meet your obligations under the Constitution of attending the conventions and doing all the things that you're supposed to do to be a fully functioning local. And if you can't do that, then I think you should really consider merging.
You mean like having equity committees and women's committees and political action committees and those kinds of things?
Those kinds of things, and also even just attending the convention. There's locals that don't attend the convention, which is, that's where our constitution gets amended. That's where appeals get heard and important issues get discussed and voted on. I think that's your obligation as a local. But yes, also to have those committees. If you can't do that, then you shouldn't. You shouldn't be here. You should merge so that you can.
Jeff, I see you nodding. Did you want to jump in?
No, I think that's right. I mean, we've all struggled with that, smaller locals, and how do they actually deliver the kinds of service and connections to their members that, that we need in order to build a union. So I was nodding in agreement with that notion that we really got to try to address that more directly and be better stewards of how we manage the local structure within CWA so that it is connecting with members.
And I think it's hard because there's some exceptions to every rule. And we all know a small local, or at least I do, very small local that doesn't have the money to function correctly, but they are a solid unit. And they're better off staying as a small, solid unit because they're just so good together. And if they merge with a bigger local, they'll just get swallowed up. And so it's a catch 22, I guess, but
I have just a couple more questions about your time as local president. During this time, the operator numbers are going down. Were there some things that you were able to do to help people as their jobs were being eliminated?
well, we did not face any layoffs in my department. So that was a help. And the way that we managed that was through voluntary retirement offers, which was fantastic for my work group. Not good for the union necessarily, because we lost members, but to see people who had enough time in the company to retire, get an extra $70,000 and make their life more comfortable was really a great plus. It was great to be able to deliver that to people through the bargaining process. To see jobs open up and upgrades, and we bargained provisions in the contract where the company had to do internal upgrades before they hired off the street. Certain percentages they had to hire internally. So to see people go from a job that paid $900 a week to a job that paid $1,500 or $1,600 a week was fantastic.
What kind of jobs were they going into?
Technical jobs, central office technician, field technician.
So did the local help them
The teacher,
study for and pass the tests?
yes, we had upgrade and transfer testing manuals. We had classes. That was another thing that we negotiated. I forgot about that, Debbie. We negotiated a training program where we, on company paid time, we had people get training to help them pass the upgrade and transfer tests. And we had union appointed folks, so we kind of ruled the program. I picked the trainers for my local. I had a group of five or six trainers, and they did that full time. They went around just training people on how to pass upgrade and transfer tests.
And the women operators were doing it.
Yes.
They were going into technical jobs, not service rep jobs,
They
or
did both.
both.
They did both.
Wow. Wow. Okay. And I'm going to sneak in this question.
Uh-oh.
During this period, you were raising two kids.
Yes.
I don't know if you were single or married.
Married.
So,
My husband is a Verizon worker too.
what does he do? And what's his name?
He was a field tech, Tom Einters.
So, how were you balancing raising kids and demanding union job?
Oh, well, I had both of my children when I was after I was elected president. So that was kind of good because I was kind of the boss. So I had some flexibility, but I can't say I really used it that much. I did not take extended leave, parental leave. I only took what Verizon gave, which was 6 weeks, I think, after the birth of your child. I took off and then went back to work. So, but I tried to leave work. I had a long commute. I tried to leave work at 4 o'clock or right around then, so that I would be home every night for dinner. I did have very good child care, which was key. I had somebody come into my house, so I could leave early in the morning without having to wake up babies and drag them to daycare, which was a big plus. So I was lucky in that regard. It was not easy. But my kids were brought up in the union life. They would come to the office with me. My daughter In 19, my daughter was born in 1998, and that was one of the years that we went into early bargaining. And I remember I was 3 months pregnant when we started, and she was 3 months old when we finished. So getting back to the point of early bargaining lasting forever, imagine being pregnant through the whole thing. It seemed like twice that long. But she came to the bargaining table with me at the end there in 1998. I don't remember if we had a strike. I don't think so. But Chris Shelton was our local chairperson for our local bargaining table, and I had my daughter in the stroller. It was one of those late nights. She was sleeping, and it was a stroller that could lay down flat, like a baby buggy kind of thing. And I brought her down in the 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock deadline. And one of the last things that we got in bargaining that year, and Chris got this, he said he got it because of my daughter, was we got triple pay for Mother's Day for all the operators in the contract that year. So my daughter
Oh,
was there at the table. She got it for us.
that's great. What's her name?
Jesse.
And your son's name?
Tommy.
And are either of them union members now?
No, unfortunately.
Okay. So you went on staff in 2004, in Avenel, New Jersey. Then you transferred to the D1 office. In 2006 or 7, you were promoted to area director in 2012, assistant to the vice president Dennis Traynor in 2015, and retired in 2022. So that's a big period. What were some of the issues and activities that stand out for you during your time on staff?
Wow. Okay. So when I worked in Avenel for it was a brief period, it was completely foreign to me. I didn't have any Verizon or a phone company assignment. My assignment was all public workers and healthcare workers, which I had no experience with at all. So it was a learning experience in both regards. My first day on the job, I went down to a brand new unit that was just organized by Tim Dubnow for the New Jersey Nurses Union. They were bargaining a first contract in Lakewood, New Jersey, with the St. Barnabas healthcare system. So, first contract for healthcare workers, first day on the job. That was CWA. So anyway,
Well, we'll talk about were the skills that you had learned bargaining with the telephone company transferable, and how did you
not really. Not
talk
really.
about that?
Well, the telephone company bargaining up until that point. The National Union did a lot of the bargaining, they behind the scenes. So you were there, you talked about issues, but you didn't actually, we didn't develop the language. People did that for us. So in these other units, it was more of a con learning the language of their contracts. And in healthcare, they had a lot that I had not, they had a lot of issues that I had never had to deal with before.
And this was a first contract.
It was a first contract. It would have been easier if it was just a subsequent contract, just trying to get improvements and wage increases and such, but it was building it from the ground up for two different units, for a hospital and a psychiatric hospital. So
So,
it
who helped you? Who mentored you? Or were you just on your own?
At first, I was on my own, but here's one thing that I learned. If you don't know what you're doing, you better ask for help. So I did, and I started working with Steve Weissman, who was really helpful.
Who's Steve Weissman?
Steve Weissman is an attorney that is hired under District One. He handles a lot of the cases out of New Jersey. There were Weissman and Mintz at the time. I think there's still Weissman and Mintz.
I think so.
Yeah. So he was helpful in trying to frame it together with me. And the whole staffing issue in healthcare was foreign to me. I didn't know how to address it.
Well, it must have been a positive experience as you moved up in the district, hierarchy.
Yeah, well, it was a good experience. I wouldn't change it now. I wouldn't say that, maybe just I might have reached out to Debbie Hayes a little sooner. Tap into that resource. Because I wasted a little time in the beginning just trying to put it together before I realized I needed help.
What were some other major events during the period then when you moved to the district office at 80 Pine Street? What were some
So,
of your assignments there?
well, I had a couple of Verizon locals in Mid-State and Brooklyn, and I had a took over the chairperson role for the Work Family Committee, which was kind of a big committee in Verizon where we bargain money in the contract each year to help address any work and family issues. There's a couple of million dollars that they put into the contract every year, and we gave people money for dependent care reimbursement. We developed different programs, trainings, domestic violence awareness programs, all different sorts of elder care programs. We reimbursed people who had were trying to care for their parents. We would reimburse them for those medical alert to give you a little peace of mind when you're at work. You could get a medical alert, and we would reimburse through that fund. Just trying to help people out who had dependent care needs or adult care, elder care needs.
I'm trying to remember the name of the woman in District One. I think she might have been a staff rep at some point who, for whom this work family committee was she was very committed to it.
I think that was most of her assignment. That was Donna Dolan.
Thank you.
Yeah, I took that assignment. They changed that assignment from her, and they put me on it.
When was it first bargained in 89 or 92?
The work family money?
Yeah. Okay.
Don't remember.
And I believe it's gone away now. Is that
No,
correct?
we still
Oh,
have
you
it.
still have it. Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
And they still do the dependent care reimbursement, even though the workforce is older and they don't have as many dependents that they need child care for anymore. But when I was in my local, it was a big deal. It really helped people a great deal pay for adequate child care.
So people could get reimbursed for their childcare expenses.
Yes.
That's huge.
Yes.
Do you remember how much?
It changed from time to time, depending on how much money we, if there was a great need, we would have to reduce it because there was a limited amount of funds, and if we had access, then we would increase it. But it was $75 for each dependent. And we capped the number of dependents. There were some times that we had to cap the number of dependents. So it could be $75 a week for two kids.
So this was something that you did as a joint committee with the company?
Yes.
So the militant District 1 also engaged in working together on certain committees together?
Sure.
Okay.
We worked on a lot of committees together.
What were some other ones?
Well, the work family one is the one that I was mostly involved with, but we had training committees, training advisory boards, we had healthcare committees. After the 2016 strike, we had, I don't know what the I don't know what the name of this committee was, but it was kind of a working together committee be after that big fight, where we actually they mended that relationship there in the after the 2016 strike with the plant department, through a committee that was chaired by
Talk
Billy Gallagher.
a little bit more about the strike, and then about that's fascinating what that joint committee was to mend the relationship.
Well, the 2016 strike going into that bargaining, I chaired that bargaining. The plant locals were under scrutiny from management, very aggressively. So management would follow workers to their job. Then they'd call them in the next day and question them about their whereabouts every minute of their day. People were getting suspended left and right for 30-day clips of suspension. It was very severe. It caused a big problem in bargaining. Bargaining sessions were very heated because of that. They were called QARs. They would call them in for what they called QAR discussions, quality assurance review, I think is what that stood for. So every day in bargaining, we hammered the company about the QARs, and this committee, and I can't remember the name of it. I could get it and get it to you if you want it. Came about after that round of bargaining, and nobody thought it would work. We just thought it was one of those committees that you throw in a contract at the end, thinking that it's going to help solve the world, and nobody does anything. But this one actually worked. And they got together after bargaining and kind of mended fences.
What did they do, and what was their mandate?
I wasn't directly involved, so but I know that they tried to help the company do the job better, where there was, bad plant situations, there would be a way for workers to report that where something actually got fixed rather than a runaround. So solved some of the frustration on the workers' end. And then management kind of took the pressure off the workers and stopped doing those QARs. And things just seemed to run a lot smoother after that.
Fascinating.
The number of disciplines greatly reduced, the number of things that had to get arbitrated, number of cases that we had to put through arbitration was greatly reduced. The relationship got better.
Anything else you want to add about being on district staff and eventually assistant to the pr vice president?
Anything that I want to add? Yes, but I wish I could just find the right words. I mean, my experience in working for the union, I just feel like it was a dream job. It didn't feel like work. It felt more like a passion or a cause that, just something that we were all fighting for. And going to work every day was, aside from having a horrible commute, going to work every day was a pleasure. I wouldn't change it for anything. I worked with incredible people, really smart people who I just learned a lot from. And
You want to name some of them?
oh my gosh, I feel like, we had the, feel like we had so many great people, Morty and Larry, earlier on in my staff life, Larry was there. But, I worked so closely with Chris through the years, from when he was the chief steward, and then he was my staff rep, and then he was the area director, and then he was the assistant, and the district vice president, and president, and Dennis. Dennis is the cream of the crop. If you've ever worked closely with Dennis, he has an incredible way of making everybody feel included and cared for and heard. And he never gives up. Getting back to my mother's favorite word, he'll stick with it forever. But make sure that before he signs a contract, everybody's okay with it and everybody's happy. We're not always happy, but we're all okay with it. Bob Master, brilliant, smart. He's a great guy. Gay Semmel, I don't know if you remember Gay.
Of
She was
course.
great. Yeah. Pat Shea, I loved working with Pat.
I want to go back to Gay for just a second.
Yeah.
She was involved with you in the operators organizing campaign, correct? Back in 83, 84, 85.
Gay was an when she was an operator, was in the earlier organizing effort that failed in the 70s, I believe it was.
Okay.
Yeah. I think she was with the National Union when we came into CWA, though, as a contractor, probably.
What would you say were some are some of your greatest achievements in your long history with the union?
I think that turning our local from unorganized, non-militant, really non-participatory group of workers into a stronger, solid, unified local who could get behind issues and use our power collectively to make the workplace better was really amazing.
Any disappointments?
Yes. Yes. My disappointments are that I didn't follow people around with a tape recorder, gaining all their knowledge before they left, like you're all doing. Like, this is great what you're doing now. I jokingly told Pat Shea when I heard she was retiring, I asked her, "Is anybody following you around with a video camera?" Because when people walk out the door, we lose so much, and there was so much knowledge that we had. I had an opportunity to talk to people more, write down all of their experiences. So I regret not doing that. And sometimes, regret not staying in touch with some of those people after they left. And then one of your emails kind of hit home. You said before it's too late, because sometimes, unfortunately, it has become too late and we've lost those people and I can't reach out to them anymore. So that's a regret.
Well, we'll send you the fascinating interview we did with Pat Shea as just one piece. Well, that's lovely to hear.
Pat Shea was a godsend to me so many times on appeal cases that I didn't know what to do with. She's a gem.
I think she told us she left her annotated constitution for the legal department because there's some things that
I hope they preserve it.
I think so.
But really, I mean,
This.
that's a regret that the transition that we don't transition well when somebody's leaving, in my opinion. We don't do what we need to onboard people in the right way. Like everybody learns, you get there, but it would be a lot easier if we did more shadowing while we had the chance. But we're all so busy, so nobody has time for that.
Exactly. That's part of we're so narrowly staffed. So this is I think I have two more questions. One is the union has certainly changed a lot over the 40 years that you've been a leader and an activist. And the external environment has changed a lot. How would you describe some of the major changes in the union? And how, why the union has been able to make those changes.
So, I don't know if you're talking about like big scale changes, like the union has expanded. They expanded from, what I was part of this small telephone world, and then, realizing that there's more to CWA and all of the mergers that we've had with the News Guild and the airline workers and the people, not that it's a merger, but organizing into different fields, healthcare, and those sort of changes have been very good. Made us bigger, made us stronger, made us more of a voice in the political world, I believe. And what was the second part of your question? What am I missing?
What was the second part of the question? I think it was how the union was able to do that.
They're great leaders. I don't know. Stick-to-itiveness. I don't know. Once they set out to do things, they just did them in CWA. I think I'm missing the point of your question.
Jeff, you want to help me on this one?
No, I mean that's a tough one. There is a level of creativity that we had with leadership like Barr and Cohen and Shelton that that welcomed change, didn't shy away from it. Even Glenn Watts before that sort of recognized that change was on the horizon and were willing to deal with it. I think that's a tough one to answer in a setting like this. It's more of a global union question as we try and figure out where we've been. But as we've talked about, these interviews are just terrific. They're a great chance for us to get a little more insight into what built our union and how it sustained over these years.
So, since you were just talking, one thing that I think of a lot is how we changed in the 40 years. Everything used to take a strike to settle things, and when we shifted our thinking to be more strategic, we didn't always have to do that. We didn't always have to strike to win major things, and using different leverages and working smarter, and using our political connections, we were able to do things without having members having to sacrifice their paycheck, and including the members in every step of the way, in educating them, making them aware of the issues, only made us stronger. Once members knew what to talk about, We've had rallies and strikes or practice picketing where news reporters would show up and just, to talk to a member, and they would be able to articulate what we were fighting for better than anybody, as well as anybody, even at the bargaining table. They could tell reporters why they were there. And that was very impressive that CWA came up with that structure on how to communicate with members and mobilize in the workplace and politically as well. So that's one change that I saw through the years, the way that we fought and the way that we won.
I think you've articulated it very, very well. When you came in was the beginning of a sharp decline in union density and power in the country, huge political backlash against unions. And within the telephone industry, the end of monopoly that was made it easier to bargain for our members and represent the members. And the development of the mobilization strategy and tactics that you've talked about were what I hear you saying was a very powerful response of the union, as well as looking at other sectors. And the other, as one of our powerful women leaders, I'd be interested if you would say any changes in terms of gender leadership within the union.
Well, we have seen changes in terms of gender leadership. When I became president of my local in the downstate area, we had a coordinating council of phone company locals. In the downstate area, I was one of how many locals? One, two, three, four, five, seven locals. I was the only woman. So it was it, now I don't know how many local presidents there are that are female, but I see changes when you go to the convention. You see changes on the floor of the convention in terms of leadership. And also at the national union level and on their executive board. There's a lot of female leadership there as well. And now we have Amina in the Secretary Treasurer's office. We had Sarah there before. So the top leadership in the union is not female president yet, but there will be someday.
Hannah, anything you want to add? Ask.
Sure. You've talked a lot about people who inspired and mentored you. I'm wondering if there's anyone that you feel like you may be inspired and mentored, and if you want to talk about them and maybe some stories about that.
Well, I know that I inspired a lot of people when I worked in the local. I definitely had a very good team of people. I worked that I, de I definitely mentored and inspired, and helped people too along the way. We had a lot of people who had issues with domestic violence in my membership and issues with substance and alcohol abuse, that we helped them get help and get healthy and get out of bad circumstances. And in staff, oh, I don't know. I would feel I'm a little embarrassed to say if I think I mentored anybody, but I'm sure that there would be people that would say that, I did have some impact on them in the workplace.
So this is your opportunity to talk to the next generation. What does life in the union, what has it meant for you, and what would you say to others who are just beginning their life in the union?
So, life in the union, as far as being a leader, has been, like I said, it's a dream job for me. It was not something that I ever thought I would ask for when I started in working for the phone company. I never intended to come in and take a role in the union. I was kind of dragged into it by my brother, but once I got a taste of it, it was just something that I knew I had to follow through with and stick with, and I wouldn't have changed a thing that we did. The next generation, the people that we left behind, I know in District 1 there's some really fantastic people, and I have no worries that they're going to do amazing, amazing things in the future. They've already been doing amazing work. There's a lot of bright leadership there that's just going to see it through. So, don't give up, stick with it, and keep on fighting. And stay strong.
And we want to send a thank you to your brother who dragged you into it.
Well,
Jeff.
thank you. I'll let him know.
Yes, please. Jeff, last words for you.
No, that this has been wonderful, Gladys. Thank you for taking the time to do this with us. You know, we, as you mentioned, we really do want to capture as many of these stories as we can before they're gone. I think what prompted us was the notion that we missed the opportunity to talk to a Morty Barr about things like this, Barbara Easterling, who's still alive, but you know, it's got memory issues at this point. So it's really been a joy for us complete working on this this project. So thanks for being a part of it. We really
Thanks for
appreciate
including me. I appreciate it. Really, I'm honored.
Well, we're honored to include you.